Morning. Thank you for coming. My name is Chris Johnson. I'm the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. I want to thank everybody for coming for our event today, the dawn of the new era, as Xi Jinping has been telling us for the last week or so, our readout on the 19th Party Congress. I'm very pleased to be joined today by several distinguished panelists. Their biographies are here in your pamphlet, so I won't bother going through them this morning. Just wanted to start off with a few sort of opening slides. The picture tells a thousand words kind of thing, and just I often find it useful to go back and think about where we have been and what that means sort of for where we are. So I had my team go back and look at the pages of People's Daily the day after each of the last several party congresses to sort of see how they compare. This is from the 14th Party Congress in 1992. As you can see, Deng Xiaoping still around, handling the coveted upper right corner of People's Daily. We have Jiang Zemin, interestingly, Li Peng right next to him, and you know the rest of the standing committee. Moving on to the 15th Party Congress, Jiang himself has moved up into the upper right corner, still sharing space with Li Peng, but we've got the rest of the standing committee. 16th Party Congress, Jiang still around, and now sharing space with Hu Jintao, and we've got the rest of the standing committee. Finally, Hu Jintao gets a little space by himself, but interestingly, he's moved out of the upper right and over to the upper left, something that nobody else did. He doesn't get a single space by himself. He's still got the full collective leadership next to him there, and then the rest of the guys below him. 18th Party Congress, Xi Jinping comes onto the scene with Hu Jintao, but there he is by himself. So it was sort of an interesting harbinger of what was going to come further along. And then we've got the rest of the standing committee, of course. And then this one. And this guy. And no individual pictures of the rest of the standing committee, a really tiny group shot where you can't really exactly tell. But lest you think that, in fact, he is starting a new Mao-like cult of personality, we have this one. This is from the height of the Culture Revolution, the 9th Party Congress. We've got 10,000 years long live for Mao Zedong, so not quite there yet. Xi Jinping still has some work to do. But with that, I'm going to go ahead and sit down, and we'll start our event today. And again, thank you so much for coming. And thanks to all of you for making the time. Andrew, I'm going to start with you. Just sort of get your sense of if you see the 19th Party Congress as a clean sweep, if you will, for Xi Jinping in terms of consolidating his power. You know, what do you sort of think that means for the sort of institutionalized rules and norms of politics? And how did the anti-corruption campaign, which you've looked at obviously very, very closely, feed into the personal arrangements from your point of view? And where do you kind of see that going forward now that Mr. Wang is no longer with us?
I mean, it's pretty clear he's got a firm grip on power. And in a sense, it is kind of clean sweep. Does he have the absolute control over everyone is not clear to me. As to the future, you know, how the anti-corruption campaign has affected the lineup this time around, of course, you have the case of Sun Zhengcai from Chongqing. I have no clue what this guy did, because the language that they've given out on him is very ambiguous. They sort of linked him to Zhou Yongkang, Ling Jiuhua, but it's more like, well, here's another rogue that was involved in the same sort of activity. I don't see that he was involved in some way in a plot. But you know, when Zhou Yongkang went down or Ling Jiuhua went down, we had all sorts of stuff coming out through either the overseas Chinese press or from Caixin, nothing on Sun. So I don't know whether he was taken down because he had too much political ambition. I don't know if he was taken down because Chongqing is as dirty as it ever was. Where does this go from here in terms of the anti-corruption campaign? Well, the official word is the anti-corruption campaign basically will go on forever. And in a sense, that's actually true. But you have to take apart the anti-corruption campaign and realize, first of all, there are two campaigns, not one. There's a campaign being run by the party, and then there's a campaign being prosecuted by the procuratorate. The party's campaign is much broader than what the procuratorate is doing, and it covers not only criminal activity, but a lot of non-criminal activity. That campaign, when you look at the numbers, the increases since 2012 are impressive. The problem is the Central Discipline Inspection Commission's statistics don't seem to be very consistent. So you never know if you compare one figure to another, if you're counting apples or oranges. But that trend has continued to go up. The procuratorate, on the other hand, who has much more consistent data, if you look at the campaign as a whole, it peaked in about 2014, 2015. 2016, it was back down to the level that it was in 2012 in terms of overall numbers. But the procuratorate's campaign actually consists of three separate campaigns. There's the campaign against the rank and file, the flies. There's the tiger hunt. And then in between is one we don't have an animal for, so I simply called it the wolf hunt. The flies went up in 2013, 2014, and then have fallen back down. That number is around 40,000. It's been about 40,000 for about 10 or 15 years. That campaign grinds on year after year after year. I don't expect to see any dramatic change in the future. The tiger hunt, of course, very dramatic. 150 civilians, maybe 70, 75 officers, maybe 50 or so tycoons. It was big in 2013, 2014, 2015, fallen back down in 2017, and it looks like it's going to run about 10 tigers a year. That cannot go on forever. And the reason is simple, and it's political. After 5 years of cleaning house, if you continue to find a lot of tigers in the house, that suggests there's something wrong with the people you're bringing in. Because, you know, presumably the tigers have been replaced by people who have been scrutinized and scrubbed much better than they were under Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin. To continue to find a lot of tigers was actually an admission of failure. The wolf hunt has ground on. It increased dramatically in 2013-14, back down to about its level before it was before. That's one that's quite interesting, because the wolf hunt really began in 1993 and 94. Huh. They've been taking out about 2,200 to 2,300 mid-level people a year since then. The fact that they're taking out that many after almost 20 years is basically, over 20 years, it's basically an admission or evidence that the campaign isn't working very well. The same could be held true of the fly hunt. Will the tiger hunt have been any more successful? Unclear to me at this stage. Mm.
And one thing I found interesting about, you mentioned the Sun Zhengcai case, is actually it seemed to me that the list of charges, or at least implied charges on him, was longer than it was for Bo Xilai even. So clearly something was going on there. Do you have a sense of what that means?
I don't. I find it baffling that, mm-hmm. you know, normally you'd have the back story. You would know what he was accused of doing. The list that they gave out is kind of a generic list nowadays. Yeah. It's almost like what you see, get on the Jiwei website in the morning, and it's a kind of generic list. It's vague, plotting against the party. What was he plotting against? Was he plotting against it politically, or was he using political power to gain money? To me, that case is still baffling. Mm-hmm.
And what's your perception of our new Discipline Inspection Commission Director, Zhao Luji? Obviously, his own personal secretary had some problems.
Yeah.
And one presumes that typically the personal secretary is the bagman for the boss. So, how does that all work? Is this a case of Xi Jinping putting, the eunuch in charge of the imperial treasury, or how do you see that?
To me, he's a very gray, not particularly accomplished. He's no Wang Qishan. He's not the fireman. He's worked his way up through Qinghai and Shanxi. doesn't seem to have any career highlights. He does have the connection, the problem. If it is true that his secretary was his bagman, then she is either setting him up for a big fall or she is setting himself up for a big fall. Because if you appoint someone that there's prima facie evidence that he's involved in corruption to head the Discipline Inspection Commission, then there's either something terribly wrong with your judgment or you're really, I don't know, are you creating tigers in order to bag them? I find this case to be quite unclear and fuzzy in my mind.
Great, thanks. Oriana, let me turn to you. Just your perspective on sort of what does the Party Congress tell you in terms of their orientation on security policy? Obviously, we have the shrinking now of the Central Military Commission to a smaller number of people, and a lot of people who seem to be friends of Xi Jinping showing up in the leadership. What do you see structurally with those changes? Is it a better match in your mind for the new force structure that we now have? And you know, what pitfalls might you see in that arrangement, if any?
Yeah, so the bottom line with what we saw at the Party Congress, if you are surprised with what happened in terms of on the security or military level, you haven't been paying attention to what Xi Jinping has been telling us about the role of the military in Chinese foreign policy over the past couple years. When Xi first came into power, my assessment was he was one of the first leaders that put his legitimacy on the line with respect to external policy. So while other leaders always had, you know, harmonious society and these types of scientific development that were internally focused, Xi's focus was on a new type of great power relations, China dream. And part of that China dream was having a strong military. And while his predecessors were kind of hush-hush about the role of the military in Chinese politics, Xi has always demonstrated more confidence and comfort with the military playing a key role in foreign policy. And so the restructuring of the military and the reforms and the anti-corruption that has occurred has all gone along these lines of basically ensuring that they have a military that is prepared for military struggle, in his words, that can fight and win wars. So the new restructuring of a Central Military Commission goes kind of hand in hand with some of the reforms that we've seen in the past. The bottom line is that China spent a lot of time modernizing their equipment, modernizing their weapons systems. And when Xi Jinping came into power, my assessment of this is that he probably showed up that first day, took a look around, and became very concerned that he had a whole force that could not use that equipment effectively. So the restructuring was designed to increase mobility, right? Because you had this very stodgy system. I used to say, if you watch Chinese news, they would make these huge deals out of military exercises, which they would move guys from like one province to another province. So if you have to make such a big deal out of that, then your mobility is not great, right? So they couldn't move people, so then you can't really project power. Part of that was they had this, the army dominated everything. And so if you look at the new reduced Central Military Commission, one of the interesting things is that you no longer see this kind of army dominance. Right? You have as a vice chairman, who was a vice chairman before, someone who is a part of the People's Liberation Army Air Force, the four members. You no longer have service chiefs or the defense minister. And I'll get back to that and what that means for operations in a second. But the four members, you have one person that had experience with the previously termed Second Artillery, now the Strategic Rocket Force, someone who had experience with the Navy and two Army. So the movement away from army dominance of the system towards the ability to conduct joint operations seems to be there. So one of the other members, you know, what are these four members on the committee and what are these two vice chairmen? The idea, I think, is that by reducing the members of the Central Military Commission, taking off the service chiefs, Xi Jinping is giving a very clear message that jointness is above the services. So it makes it very clear now that that type of these national theater commands, the joint commands that were a part of the restructuring that happened over a year ago, that is how they're doing business now, and that's where the command and control goes through. So the services might now be more in charge of kind of what is the case in the United States, like training, equipping, readiness, but they're not going to have a same role as the members of the CMC in terms of determining doctrine and how military plays a role with other tools. So this is a huge shift, not only towards a more operational command, but also if you look at the members that are actually put on there, what their positions are. So you have the chief of the joint staff. That's not surprising, given the focus on joint operations. But then the other two of the other members seem to be kind of Xi loyalists, right? Xi cronies. One of them is now in charge of the political work department. The other one, deputy secretary of the central committee for discipline inspection. And so it seems that while as a military specialist, I focus on the operational readiness component of what she's doing, that there is this balance between choosing individuals that are loyal, and then the other two members that were chosen are said to have combat experience. And this is a strange, you know, the last time China fought a war was 1979 against Vietnam. Because that war went so poorly, you very rarely hear about it in China. But the Chinese media did report that these two individuals were like war heroes and like veterans and had combat experience. So to me, it seems like the balance between needing Xi loyalists, also having, you know, people with combat experience, a balance among the services, that Xi Jinping is trying to balance the desire to have a professionalized force with his desire, as you showed with this picture, to consolidate party control, right? And in Xi Jinping thought that was incorporated into the Constitution, it did state that they wanted a strong military but ensured that it was under party control and maintained discipline. So the big question for effectiveness is how do these two goals potentially contradict each other, right? If you have, you want good command and control in combat, and it's probably beneficial for China that you have this joint command structure now. But at the same time, the more power is centralized in a few individuals, the more that a few people have to be in the loop when decisions are made, the less likely the Chinese military can adapt to the fog of war when conflict actually happens. And so hopefully we'll never see that in play, but I think Xi Jinping is playing a very dangerous game by putting loyalty in front of professionalism.
And to that point, I mean, one thing that's striking is not only have they downsized the overall size of the CMC, but there also appears to be this sort of broader distinction perhaps in the past between vice chairman and members, and will they go back to an older system where actually the standing committee, if you will, of the CMC is the chairman and the vice chairman, and the members are there in sort of almost an ex officio capacity? Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of how that's playing out? And then, you know, you mentioned this tension. It's it, in many ways, it's the old red versus expert debate, you know, back again. And I think it's very clear from other things we're seeing, the resubordination of the People's Armed Police, the sort of paramilitary force back under the Central Military Commission exclusively as opposed to joint subordination to the Ministry of Public Security and the CMC. Obviously, this idea of fighting and winning wars also means keeping the party in power. You know, when you look at the restructuring as a net balance, how much do you think it is tweaking the problems from the old command system that made them combat ineffectual, and how much of it was reemphasizing the party's control? Because I think it's fair to say that while under Hu Jintao the military never was rogue per se, they had a pretty nice sized gray area within which they were operating. That's been dramatically reduced, it seems, under Xi.
Yeah, so there's a lot, it's a very opaque system, so there's a lot of unknowns here. So originally, when maybe 3 years ago, when people would bring up the possibility of kind of rogue PLA actions, this was usually in certain situations that maybe tensions were high between the United States and China, maybe you had an incident at sea or in the air, and people would say, you know, the PLA isn't under, maybe isn't under the control of the party, they're doing what they want to do. You know, and I used to make the statement that, like, that is completely, the party has complete control of the military, right? If you're in any military, you don't violate your orders lest you be severely punished, especially if you're in the People's Liberation Army. So I was pretty confident that the party had complete control. But what confuses me is then if the party had so much control, then why is she so obsessed with party control over the military, right? So right after the Party Congress, she went and gave a speech to the People's Liberation Army in which he mentioned, you know, basically warned them and said, you know, we all have to get rid of these poisonous weeds in the military, and you better be dedicated to this military reform or else. So it makes you think, like, who is not on board with the military reform? This is anecdotal, but my discussions with Chinese military officers, I usually get the opportunity to interact with those at a very high level, but the Chinese aren't really comfortable with low-level officers interacting with foreigners. And I had a situation in which, just luckily, there was a translator who was a low-level officer, so I got to interact a bit about the reforms. And it seems that it might be partially a generational difference. the younger generation of the Chinese military wants to see that professionalized force. One that, you know, sure, they have that party loyalty and they're red in that way, but not one that has that domestic repression role that they've, you know, somewhat successfully pushed off to the PAP about, 10 years ago. And so they like the idea that this is going to be a world-class force, something that she said, by 2050, we are going to be a world-class, professional, you know, first-class military. But I think maybe some of the older generation individuals that kind of like the cushy system they're in now, and also the unpredictability, I think, about who's going to get called in to be investigated or not, right? There's been, I guess, like 60 or 70 generals who's been investigated, and some surprises from my point of view. I mean, I've heard allegations back and forth about whether Wu Shengli is under investigation, for example. And Wu Shengli, I thought, was like a hero of the of the Chinese
Mahan.
Right? He was, you know, he was the one that was promoting this modern Chinese Navy that allows China to project power all over the globe. So I'm not sure how much, you know, of this is personality driven. You know, why does Xi Jinping feel like there's such a necessity to push this? And there is always trade-offs, right? The more soldiers are spending reading their Xi Jinping thoughts, the less they're engaging in what she says they need to do, which is realistic combat training to prepare for contingencies.
Great, thank you. Scott, we'll come to you to talk a little bit about the economy. You know, hard to tell because we have to sort of wait for the government shoes to drop to have a really good sense of who is going to be running the economy. But obviously, the promotion of Liu He to the Politburo, the creation of the Financial Stability and Development Committee at the National Financial Work Conference in July, which presumably will start doing things once that government reshuffle is over as well. You know, when we look at Xi Jinping's work report, I think the general consensus is it's from a U.S. interest point of view. If you look at the other quadrants, domestic politics, foreign policy, even security policy, not the greatest news stories. Economics, maybe. So give us your sense of what you think the Congress means for their forward planning there.
Sure. Let me make sort of three basket of comments on economic policy. The first is sort of broad framework from the 19th Party Congress, and then sort of the specific policies that they that Xi Jinping highlighted as their top priorities, and then on terms of personnel, who's likely to have which jobs, and what might that mean in terms of overall direction. I mean, to me, the big takeaway, and again, this is in some ways some signs of continuity, and we shouldn't be overly surprised in the same way that we've seen with personnel and corruption in the military. But to me, I mean, it just speaks loud and clear the era of reform and opening is over. And if we call it the new era with a capital N and a capital E, it doesn't mean that China's not interested in reforming anymore. It's just sort of the content of that reform and what reform means, I think, has changed quite a bit. Seeing broadly, the vision that we've had in our mind of China over the past 40 years is that reform was the transition from plan to market, right? And summed up by that Chinese phrase, you know, feel the stones to cross the river, mo zhe shi tou guo he. There's no, and that other side of the river was the free market economy. There's no other side of the river bank anymore. They are where they are now is where they want to be. Obviously, they want to improve things, but this is the hybrid system they have with market mechanisms and state intervention. I think what Xi Jinping said is that's here to stay. And so we had there was a Chinese official who came to Washington last week to give a briefing to the policy community who said, and he summed up socialism with Chinese characteristics for us. Number one is equity, egalitarian outcomes. Second, a high percentage of the economy in state-owned enterprise hands. And third, medium and long-term planning, which means five-year plans in industrial policy. So I think that all of that is going to stay. And reform is going to be about making this system, making China Inc. run better, not about getting rid of it one day down the road. In terms of the top policy priorities that Xi Jinping identified in his political report, number one, supply-side reform, reducing output and capacity in infrastructure-related industries, cement, steel, aluminum, all that stuff that builds the buildings, and dealing with the debt that is a part of that overcapacity. Second was technology innovation and making China an innovative society so that they could compete globally in the very top rungs of supply chains. Revitalizing rural China was third. We don't hear a lot about rural China, but it's got as big challenges as it's ever had, even though there's been a lot of progress. Toward the bottom of the list was improving the socialist market economy system, which is about SOE reform, which is about the fiscal system, financial system, competition policy. Those are things that they want to work on. That's where you might look for clear liberalization in the domestic economy. And for me, the number one thing I would focus on there is with fiscal reform, changing the way local government budgets are put together, the implementation of property tax so that they're not dependent on local companies' growth, so that they have more stability. I think that's going to be sort of the key to watch there. And then they did talk about openness. That was number six, the last one. There was a little mention of making things more open for multinationals and American companies, having this negative list system, liberalizing in services. But the big emphasis in his speech, which was the same balance in the 13th five-year plan from the year before, was that China was going to make the world open to China. It was going to be a trade power. It was going to invest abroad, build the Belt and Road. And so I think their idea of what openness now globally is different than what it used to mean. In terms of people and personnel, sort of three big baskets. First is, Liu He, who has been the head of the leading small group on economics and finance and the deputy director of the National Development and Reform Commission. He's, as you said, he's on the Politburo. He's most likely going to be a vice premier. Could be vice premier and head of finance. I think it's possible he might end up being sort of China's economic policy czar. And he's also going to head probably this Financial Stability and Development Commission that they just announced that, it was announced this summer that it was being created. So he comes with, the experience that makes one believe that he would be pushing on the liberalization side of reform. I think that's possible, but also he's the inventor of the idea of supply-side reform, of using government, administrative, and party intervention to reduce capacity. So he's comfortable using the power of the state whenever needed. On the industrial policy side of things, if he is not the czar of all economics, then it's really unclear. You can't look at the Politburo membership and say, oh, here's an obvious person to run industrial policy and put together the next five-year plan. Now, someone might say, well, maybe that would be the premier. But Li Keqiang looks like he's more likely to be boxed in than be given a lot of room. I think the big unknowns for me, still wild cards, which are maybe wild things to speculate about, is Wang Qishan. Might Wang Qishan stick around as vice president? If he sticks around as vice president, which would be unprecedented, right, breaking all those supposed rules that don't exist, right, then he might have the portfolio for managing the relationship with the United States, at least on economics. We've always had that. That's always been a challenge. If he did that, Li Keqiang would be even smaller. I kind of used to joke that Li Keqiang was the bureau chief of administrative reform. He might go down to the section chief if they finish. And then I guess the other thing we don't know about is the other Politburo Standing Committee member, also surnamed Wang Huning. What is Wang Huning going to do? He came up with the idea of the China Dream, is sort of the intellectual source of lots of different ideas, and he could play a larger role on the way they conceive of economic policy. And so it's interesting that Xi Jinping is starting a new era, but some of the most important people who have been with him and who might have the biggest say, Liu He and Wang Huning, have been inside the system at the top for decades now. So it, to me, looks like a very interesting group of characters.
Yeah, just following up on a couple of those things, of course, you mentioned supply-side structural reform, which is now in the Constitution. So
yes.
Obviously that means it's pretty important.
But of course, the other legacy element there, I guess you could say, is the authoritative person, where he talked a lot about the dangers of boundless credit growth and debt and things of this nature. And you know, you'll recall as well as I do the sort of debate after that piece ran. About 6 months later, everyone was saying, well, what happened to the authoritative person? Well, he's just kicked ass, he's on the Politburo, and as you say, he might be the economic czar. So I think it'd be worthwhile for all of us to go back and read that piece again. I mean, how do you see those pieces fitting together? And you know, you mentioned Wang Huning. You know, clearly, at least so far, he's adopted the Liu Yunshan role. He's running the campaign on studying the 19th Party Congress. He's the idea man. And so then that kind of leaves that space of the other half of his old job at the Policy Research Office, which is this kind of strategic operations center for looking at the broader landscape. You know, do you see anyone on the Politburo who naturally fits in that role? I find it interesting they've reshuffled all the key central committee departments except for that one so far. So something's going on there.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm still scratching my head exactly on how they are going to divvy up the work and implement the plan. I guess for me, the key moment where we'll learn a lot will be the Central Economic Work Conference in December, where Xi Jinping will not only identify the top priorities for the next year or perhaps five, you'll see clarity in the leading small groups and in maybe some of these other jobs, at least signaling. We'll learn, for example, is it more likely that Guo Shuqing will be the central bank governor to replace Zhou Xiaochuan, or will be Jiang Chaoliang, the current party secretary of Hubei? So I think, you know, even, you know, a lot of times that authoritative person is actually in an argument with himself.
Yeah.
So for several months it was, we're really worried about debt, we're really worried about overcapacity. And then, oh, we need to revitalize growth, we need to stimulate. And, you know, late 2016, early 2017 was about some stimulus, right? And now they're feeling good, they've got good growth numbers. So we might see, you know, the return of the authoritative person, that side of Liu He, in the next year in conversations in Beijing. It does. People tried to consistently signal that SOE reform, that they were serious about that. And they didn't mean privatization. What they mean is mergers and acquisitions, changing the lineup of the leadership, making them come to account so that, and if they're ones that are really bad, really forcing them to undergo significant changes. So I think, you know, one thing that also signals that is the Central Committee. I don't know if all of you have reviewed the 204 members of the Central Committee or the 176 who are on the alternative members. I mean, what do you do on a Thursday night? Of course you wouldn't do that. So if you weren't doing what I was doing. But you would notice amongst that 204 members, not a single one is currently the head of a state-owned enterprise. And in the 18th, 17th, and 16th, they all had four or five SOE people, chairmen, who were currently in those jobs, zero. Now, there are two who just stepped down this past summer and fall, one the head of their COMAC, the commercial aircraft company, and the one head of Sinopec, but that's not their jobs now. So what this signals to me is that perhaps, if we're again reading tea leaves, maybe they're serious about SOE reform, since there's no SOE leaders there, and it's part of the broader trend where they invited in some private business people to talk over the last few years to remind them who's boss. Uh-huh. And so again, this is, you know, Xi Jinping doesn't scream out liberal Adam Smith, but he does scream out, he can do, if he decides something is a very high priority, he can take it on.
Yeah, and just to interesting other points. You didn't mention Han Zheng, who looks like he's headed to executive vice premier. So do you see him as sort of a nothing burger in that post? And then to the point about SOEs, I mean, it's interesting, Wang Yong, who of course used to be the SASAC chief, then became a state counselor, kind of overseeing that portfolio. A lot of people thought he was headed to the Politburo. He didn't, which looks like he's headed to, you know, the National People's Congress or something along those lines. Do you think that kind of reinforces what you're saying about SOEs?
I think the latter does. In terms of where Wang Yong goes, and there's so many different spots where you could try and make a guess. Han Zheng could play a much larger role. He spent his whole career in Shanghai, right? So he's not got the experience of managing the central government and party industrial policy bureaucracy. But he certainly could. And given that Shanghai is meant to be a symbol of and reform at the front edge for China. And since Jiang Zemin's from Shanghai, maybe he wants to, you know, keep those that are potential enemies as close as possible. That could be what he does. But I still think we ought to, you know, a lot of the weight center of economic policy making will be with Liu He's group. That's where I would start first and then see how the other pieces complement him.
Great, thanks. Okay, taking a little bit more of a forward look, what we might think this all means for the future. Andrew, we talked a little bit backstage about the new National Supervision Commission idea. You mentioned that we have, in effect, two anti-graft campaigns, one run by the party and then what the procuratorate is doing. Obviously, part of this seems designed to put those, fuse those two things together. You know, what do you think about sort of the viability of that? Obviously, we have Li Jiangxu, it looks like, headed to the National People's Congress. So whether it's real, whether it's, you know, rule by law or rule of law, they're going to make an effort on legalization of all of this. Your sense of if that's just theatrics or if there's, you know, something real there. And then, you know, Xi Jinping obviously made some hay in his speech about talking about how the Shuanghui system is being, you know, demobilized, but then there's this, you know, very amorphous thing called detention that's going to replace it. So your thoughts on all of those things?
Well, in some ways, it seems to be simply a repackaging of the existing system. When the supervisory ministry was set up in the 1980s, they quickly discovered that it did exactly what the Discipline Inspection Commission was doing, because many state officials were also party members. So they merged them back in 1993. The two are basically inseparable. There is some difference in what they do. The Discipline Inspection Commission focuses on people. The Supervisory Ministry tends to focus more on problematic procedures. But the reality is the two basically work hand in glove. Because they have prior jurisdiction, the procuratorate has basically just been their kind of their hands. Once they've got a decision, once they've got the evidence they've gathered, they kind of pass the case over, remand it to the procuratorate, who then goes through and has to do a second investigation, work through the evidence once again, then take it to court. And so it's a kind of long, complicated system. And theoretically, if you merge them all into these new committees, then they don't really, you would really streamline it in the sense that you can do one investigation rather than having to do two. The other problem they have is that as a non-state entity, the party doesn't have any judicial authority. It really doesn't have the authority to gather evidence that can be submitted to a court. That evidence has to be developed by the procuratorate. Well, the way they work now is they simply, the Discipline Inspection Committee, using its party authority and the Shuanghui authority, basically extracts a confession from a suspect. They then hand the confession over to the procuratorate along with the individual, and then they go to court, and theoretically the confession's not valid, because you signed it with the party, not with the procuratorate. And the way they finesse that, I'm told, is, well, the court says, well, you signed it. You signed it, you must be guilty, right? And you say, well, I signed it under duress. What do you mean, duress? You know, they really don't take, you know, the allegations of torture and so forth. And my sense, it's more of kind of indefinite detention, intensive interrogation, rather than beating them with rubber hoses and so forth. So in theory, you merge these things. But how do you merge a party organization with a judicial organization, one that has state and judicial authority, with one that really doesn't have any formal authority except the authority that it derives from the fact that you join the party, you submit to the party? So I do see it's something of a streamlining, but I also see it as problematic from a legal point of view. And so we say, well, this is to to improve the rule of law, but you're improving the rule of law in effect by legalizing things that really aren't within the rule of law. So I don't see it as a dramatic change. I see it pretty much as a formalization of what they do already. And in that sense, it is an institutionalization of the existing system, which I guess you could say, if you institutionalize it, you put it on a regular basis, you put in rules on detention, no more than 3 months. You have to go back. I noticed you, after 3 months, if you still haven't gotten the guy to confess, you just go and ask for 3 more months. And there was no saying what happened after 6 months, but if you can ask after 3 months, apparently you can ask after 6 months. Becomes almost a procedural protection to keep you in indefinite detention. So I don't see it as a dramatic change. It's something of a change.
Yeah, thanks. Oriana, one thing that was interesting in Xi's work report, you know, not too much really in there on the foreign policy and security front. Interesting that he chose to highlight South China Sea island building as an achievement for the 5 years, which, you know, sort of in some ways, typically their approach there has been to kind of do a Nike thing, don't talk about it, just do it, you know, and yet he chose to talk about it. So that's interesting. And then, you know, it strikes me there's been widely differing assessments of how to read Xi Jinping's discussion of Taiwan in the speech. The general consensus seems to be it's a little harder edge maybe than previous political work reports. So your sense of, you know, how those issues are developing, hot spots going forward, and you know, if you can tie that in, what do you think President Trump is going to say to Xi Jinping about South China Sea in particular and Taiwan?
So, you know, you already mentioned his 3.5-hour speech. He didn't mention specific foreign policy issues, right? The United States didn't really come up, though he made the statement of the need to construct a steady and beneficial diplomatic framework with big powers, which was probably directed towards the United States. He didn't mention North Korea. There was one statement about friendly relations with neighboring countries, but that was probably more directed towards the One Belt, One Road kind of Central Asia countries. And it is interesting, the one thing he decided to highlight was land reclamation in South China Sea and how well that was going. But even though in the work report he didn't lay out specifics about these issues, you know, in my view, he presented a very clear foreign policy approach. People have looked at the work report, for example, and have mentioned that he had described China as like a strong country or a great country 26 times. In my reading of Xi Jinping's speech, I don't know of any speech in which he has ever brought up the phrase biding time and hiding your capabilities. Right. So this gives you this view that he is very comfortable, maybe more risk acceptant than his predecessors, with certain policies that could potentially lead to conflict not only with neighbors but with the United States as well. He mentioned in his speech, again, the need to be combat ready for civilians and the military to have improved relations. I see that as kind of societal problems associated with support of the military. And he also said very openly that China's going to face difficulties to come, which I took as a sign of, you know, he's openly saying we're going to pursue these policies that are, you know, important from the Chinese perspective of national interest, national security, even if it means conflict.
Right.
So what does that mean moving forward? I think the first thing is we talk a lot about, when you talk about South China Sea, for example, Chinese coercive diplomacy in the South China Sea. So that's referring to, on the political science side, we say sort of the simultaneous use of threats, displays of military force, coupled with diplomatic maneuvers. There's another term used a lot in DC called like gray zone warfare, right? This idea that China kind of harasses or uses military assets at a level of escalation that is below a threshold that it would provoke a U.S. response. We also talk a lot about the Chinese military having an anti-access area denial strategy, basically trying to deny, degrade, disrupt other countries' abilities to deploy forces in the region. I bring these up because I think the Chinese focus on the military is going to shift away from all of these.
Mm-hmm.
But these are strategies that China had to employ to impact the operations of more powerful countries at a time when it was unable really to operate itself. But the goal was never just to be able to be annoying to other countries. The goal was always to be able to project power, at least regionally, and I think it's up for debate whether globally is the goal by 2050. And so to do that, you no longer just want to be engaging in A2AD. You want to be developing the capabilities which joint operations, all this restructuring suggests they're going to do to be able to operate. So my big concern is I think the number one thing that imposes caution on Xi, on the Communist Party, for example, from trying to forcibly reunify with Taiwan, is not the costs that, you know, maybe the United States threatens to impose, but the fear that they'll be unsuccessful. It really is this uncertainty about their military capabilities, and once that uncertainty is resolved, and Xi is very confident, all right, we got the mechanization, we got the informatization by 2020, you know, 2035, we have this good military, like, 25th, we have a world-class military. Once they become more confident, I think it's going to be very hard to deter them, almost impossible to deter them moving forward. So what does this mean for the South China Sea and what President Trump, is he going to say anything? My readout, and things can always change, right? President Trump often says things that are not on the agenda, so you can't hold me to this, but my readout from the White House of the trip suggests that the South China Sea is not even on the agenda with China. He has made the decision to prioritize the North Korea issue, which my personal view is that China can't really help us to the degree that he wants them to anyway, and he's basically conceding the strategic space of the South China Sea, which lies at the heart of the United States' ability to project power and at the heart of U.S. leadership in the Asia-Pacific. So he's going to maybe get some symbolic gains on economics, right? Maybe some Chinese company agrees to open up a factory somewhere in middle America, and for that, we're basically going to not contest the South China Sea position. He's also going to APEC, also going talking to ASEAN countries. That might be a time to bring up the South China Sea, but in my mind, you know, he didn't bring it up with Xi the last time they met. If he doesn't bring it up again, that's only going to embolden the Chinese to pursue a more aggressive policy with a stronger role of the military in that policy.
Yeah, I think you're right, especially to highlight what appears to be the kind of formal death knell, I guess you could say, of keeping a low profile internationally. I mean, it was actually really kind of awkward watching the foreign minister Wang Yi squirm when he was asked the question, you know, so does Tao Guangyanghui still exist, you know, by a foreign reporter? And he sort of said, well, yes, but we don't talk about it anymore. And you could see clearly, no, it doesn't. And so one thing she did mention in the speech, though, which was interesting, was again the notion of the period of strategic opportunity, which, you know, at least from my perspective, I've always seen as something of a handbrake on them going toward a very aggressive, you know, sort of stance in the region, and or the Soviet road of, you know, putting all your money into military, because of course implied in a judgment that the external security environment is sufficiently benign for you to be able to focus on your internal development is a notion. It makes it more difficult for you to make the case we need to be big and snarly. How do you see that sort of fitting in?
So I think sometimes it can not be so useful to compare what China is doing with what previous great powers have done. My sense is that how a great power decides to accumulate and exercise power actually varies across history. And that has to do not only with, some people would argue, the norms or standards or nature of the domestic system of that country, but also the state of international affairs and technology. So the United States, during its rise, did not seek colonies, even though the great power that was in decline at the time, Great Britain, had colonies all over the world. Mm-hmm. Would we say that, you know, the United States was not interested in being a global power then? We wouldn't say that, because what had happened was the nature of power had changed, and the United States probably assessed that Great Britain's hold on those colonies is actually what sapped their power to begin with, and so the United States pursued a different avenue of international institutions, alliances, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding is that China is now looking at that system that the United States has put into place, overseas basing, all these external commitments, and they see that as the same type of sap on U.S. power as the United States saw colonies of Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And so the reason that China isn't kind of pursuing that route maybe is not so much at this stage that they're afraid of, like, flexing their muscles or upsetting their neighbors, but more that they see that that was an ineffective way of, and now it's an ineffective way of exercising power. It's going to, in their mind, lead to the demise of the United States. So they're now debating. I think that's what One Belt, One Road is. Mm-hmm. They're debating, okay, well, how are we going to establish our global presence? Mm-hmm. And how are we going to exercise our influence in a different type of way? So I think originally maybe You know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, the reason China wasn't kind of being more difficult, they were always afraid of counterbalancing coalitions. I think especially now with the U.S. leadership role, people would say is declining in the region, I don't think they're as fearful as that kind of coalition forms, but that I don't think is what's preventing them from pursuing those types of policies. I think instead it's that they want to rise successfully, and they think mimicking certain types of behavior that makes the United States a great power will actually prevent them from doing that.
Great, thanks. Scott, another thing, sort of forward-looking part of Xi's speech was we see the entrance again in some ways of the notion of the exportability of China's model, clearly a reference to that, fairly cleverly done in terms of, you know, if you're a developing country and you want to develop quickly but maintain your independence, i.e. not the restrictions that come with those pesky things like rule of law and so on, transparency, you know, this is new. One thing that's striking is I think there's a risk that it's being overplayed. You know, I mean, one of the great sort of frustrations is that Xi Jinping, I think, has is, in effect, why are we so bad at soft power? This is something I think he complains about repeatedly internally to his subordinates. And in some ways, maybe this is just another effort to repackage and, you know, design a new method of soft power for them. But, you know, you've done a lot of work on global governance. You just published a book on this. How do you see China trying to manage the rules, if you will, internationally? You know, you get the sense, as Oriana was just saying, of a perception, at least in the region, of, you know, running in an open field with no tackling. You know, how do you see them playing with that?
Yeah, I think what they plan to do on the international economic side looks relatively similar and consistent with the discussion on military and security affairs. Of course, the trajectory to get there has been different. China, rather than developing sort of asymmetric alternative ways to, you know, stop and bother us, joined the system. Right, as junior members, they went from being outsiders to junior members to learning to being regular participants to providing leadership and things from the WTO to IMF. And in the last few years, they've started to provide more public goods, international public goods. And so there's a sort of clear trajectory from outsider to insider to providing more leadership. And that was clear in the political report that Xi gave, in Wang Yi's comments, and I expect we'll continue to see. In terms of the public goods on the economic side, the two that seem to be, I guess there's sort of three that they are going to emphasize. One is sort of protecting the public commons. So there were Paris, climate change, oceans, space, more in Antarctica. In the Arctic, you're going to see the Chinese more front and center. Then in terms of aid and development, AAIB is not the last AAIB. There's going to be more institution building, I think, here. And the Belt and Road, which has been mostly slogans and finding projects that already exist to say that they fit in, I think they're going to develop a lot. They're going to build real projects with real money behind them and put a lot of diplomatic pressure on countries in Central Asia and elsewhere to participate. So I think we're going to see them stepping forward there. And I think the third is what you alluded to, this idea of the China model or the Beijing consensus. Officially, China has always kept away because they do not want to be seen as what they call building a separate kitchen, challenging the West. They want to be seen as good participants who have modest tweaks and ideas for the system, but don't oppose it. And I think his discussion in the political report about providing an alternative is getting as close as they can have ever come to talking about a China model that basically legitimates state intervention in the economy and in international trade, that downplays the role of non-state actors across the board. So to me, it adds up to a relatively illiberal model that they want to legitimate. It was interesting in this briefing that I heard last week, there was a discussion from some of the folks present about, you know, obstacles to getting into the China market, you know, market access issues and things like that. And the answer back first included the standard things one says, which is China will open its market further. Foreign companies aren't discriminated against. They've just sort of lost some of the special privileges they originally had. But added to that was something new, which was, you know, some of the things that people say that we're doing now are against the rules. We're going to change those rules. We're going to make those things legal. And so I expect there's going to be more effort at rulemaking and writing. And then lastly, you know, there's this phrase that that they've come up with, the community of a common destiny. I'm not really sure what that means. It sounds good. I think we're going to hear it a lot. And I think it's this idea of, that gets to Oriana's point, is can we build our international influence and connectivity to others without entangling alliances? Can we create almost sort of a voluntary system of collaboration where we have no, where it's all benefits and no costs?
Right.
And so I think we're, that's where they're going to right now, that is maybe different than the way the U.S. tried to extend its international power.
And kind of related to that, I mean, you have this community of common interest, and then we have what appears to be a new line on a free and open Indo-Pacific, which does seem to imply entangling alliances and notions of containment and so on. And then how do you translate a free and open Indo-Pacific when you're not doing free trade as part of that? So your thoughts on that and how China may or may not be able to exploit that?
I think for them the era of strategic opportunity continues because the under the Obama administration, I think the opportunity for them is that they could push and turn up the temperature on the pot without getting pushback, because the United States was primarily interested in a deal on climate change in Iran, and that the U.S. was relatively permissive on any individual Chinese action and sort of just the nature of Chinese power. I think the reason they feel that there's still more room to grow isn't that the U.S. is not now interested in Chinese power, but that we have a relatively chaotic policy process, very unclear Asia policy, and North Korea is so important that seems to trump, pardon the pun, anytime we want to push hard on economics. And so I think the Chinese have, their immediate reaction after Secretary Tillerson gave his speech here at CSIS a few weeks ago was, well, we've seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that you can depend on India? That was the big question for them. And on, you know, so I think they realize that there's lots of potential risks. Most of those risks aren't about the grand design that the Trump administration is developing, but about the things that are very unexpected, that you just can't predict, that the administration or the president at any moment could change course in any one policy area, which the Chinese don't like to work in that way. They like predictability. And even if it was predictability where the U.S. was going to really treat China as a rival, that would almost be easier for them than to deal with this messy world where they are very unsure what's going to happen. So but overall, I think they feel they're in the driver's seat. I also expect relatively symbolic types of outcomes from the president's visit to China on economic issues as the same on security.
Great. Thanks. Okay. Lots to chew on there. As is typical here, we'll turn to the audience now for some questions. If you would, please identify yourself, wait for the microphone to come to you, and do keep your question to a question rather than a speech. We'll start up here in the very front.
Sure. Thank you very much. Krishna Guha with Evercore ISI. So I had a question about the evolving relationship between the Chinese authorities, Chinese state, and the tech giants that have now emerged in China. And it seems to me that in everywhere in the world, and including here in the US, the political system is in a sense running to play catch up with the growth in the power and influence of other tech companies. But China's really the only example outside the US where you have these gigantic and extremely sophisticated technology companies, but also where there is scope for potentially very, very important breakthroughs in artificial intelligence and so forth in the period ahead, will have large military and strategic implications, as well as implications for domestic control, for soft power exertion, and so forth. So I appreciate this wasn't the central topic of the party Congress, but I'd be fascinated to see the panelists' views as to this evolving relationship between the Chinese leadership and their technology giants. We have seen some suggestions that there's been efforts to reassert a little bit of party control and influence over the tech giants themselves of late. Love to hear more. Thank you.
I'll start. My favorite sentence in the political report reads, "Maintain the party's leadership of all work, party, government, military, civilian, education, east, west, south, north, and middle, the party leads everything." If you didn't, you know, it's so clear. And that includes business. This is different than the three represents, right, of the late 1990s, where the party represented the leading, you know, edge of the economy. And so I think they're trying to avoid the Russia problem of the 90s and Yeltsin and oligarchs, and reminding the business overall who's in charge. Obviously, these tech companies, most of them are private, so they don't originate from the party. But they basically have been told, and it's true, that they depend on industrial policy support as much as anybody. Even a company like Alibaba, which is highly creative, innovative, doing lots of new things, benefits from being able to create a cloud business in China that has no serious foreign competitors and has a lot of financing, low credit financing that helps them go abroad. I think they're just, it's obviously, so they need to remind. Now, at the same time, of course, these companies are coming up with new and different ideas that the party never thought of, that bureaucrats never think of. And so to some extent, there's what looks like industrial policy that gets the companies to do something that generates a product or service that the government wanted, really was something that was already in process that the government or party just endorses. And I think you get both. And we will continue to see both. Just at the end of the day, in terms of its relevance for society and how it's deployed, and that it's available to the state for not only commercial gains but domestic security and foreign policy. That's why one of the most interesting things that Xi Jinping has innovated is the creation of this leading small group on civilian-military integration. I think that's a big focus of figuring out how to make sure that the commercial interests of industry and the national interests of China don't ever diverge too much.
I just add a few points. I sharpen that a little bit. I think one thing that's striking about what we've seen with the dance between the leadership and the tech companies just in the last 6 months, I would argue, is that it appears to me anyway that the tech companies, the party has kind of had to remind them, you know, first and foremost, you're an arm of the state, whether you're quasi-private or public or, you know, anything in between. And what's striking based on their reactions, where you have, you know, very cosmopolitan, sort of savvy people talking about the realization of communism in their lifetime and, you know, things like this, it's clear they didn't get it, you know, and operating in that system, they should get it. They should know how to, you know, sort of manage it. I think it's very similar, frankly, to Xi Jinping's handling of the anti-corruption campaign with the behavior of princelings, right? And so if you're doing something you shouldn't be, and I don't like it, and, you know, one of my guys comes to you, or you get some signal that, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, if you're smart, you stop, right? You know, I call it sort of the candidates for Darwin's waiting room. You know, it's a litmus test. If you keep going, you know, you're going to get whacked. And I think we've seen, you know, some of that. And, you know, behavior, it depends on your high-tech guy. You know, I think people like Robin Lee, people like Pony Ma have largely said, of course we're collecting all this data and it's yours, you know, please be our guest. I think Jack Ma considers himself more of a maverick, as, you know, sort of being in a different spot. And then let's think about the next gen bats, right, the younger guys who clearly adopt the sort of Silicon Valley, we're disruptive point of view. You know, guys of the older generation are familiar with working in this system. They know the constraints. They know what they're supposed to do before they're asked to do it. You know, how will these younger guys integrate when Xi Jinping is making very clear, you know, I've got the con on this. So it'll be an interesting space to watch develop. And then just one final point. You know, we worry, a lot of people worry so much about, whoa, these guys have such a massive market cap. What's going to happen when they come out and start competing, you know, globally? As Scott pointed out, they're operating in a totally controlled ecosystem. And they're going to have this huge drag of the party asking them to invest in technologies that in many cases have absolutely nothing to do with their core business, but are part of the innovation plan under the 13th five-year plan. That's going to create a lot of sort of drag for these companies. So it's an important thing to watch. Paul here.
Oh, stand up. Yeah. I'm Paul Hare from George Washington University. My question is primarily for Scott as well, but I certainly welcome other comments. And it's basically about where the what the 19th Party Congress means for the 12th plenum agenda from the 18th Party Congress. I mean, when the third plenum agenda was unveiled in late 2013, I and others interpreted it as very dungist. And there was a lot of concern or a lot of prevailing analysis since then that that agenda has stalled. Your statement that the 19th Party Congress has reaffirmed the importance of the state center, I think, raises two possibilities. Either we misinterpreted, I misinterpreted the third plenum agenda, or she has retreated from it since. So does the 19th Party Congress reaffirm the intentions of, behind the third agenda, or is it going in a different direction? And if so, why?
Sure. To some extent, maybe everyone gets to eat a little crow on the on the interpretation of the third plenum. If we go back to the original sentence, there was a two-part sentence. We love the first part because we have short. I have short attention span, so I wouldn't pay attention to the second one. But the first part was have the market play a decisive role in the allocation of resources. We all remember that one. And then the second part of the sentence, no period, semicolon. Was and have the make the state play a better role, right? It was right there, and that that is in the political report, right? So, you know, I think actually, you know, so we could criticize ourselves for being overly hopeful, and wanting and trying to foresee the direction we'd like China to go in, but I do think that to some extent Xi Jinping was getting his legs early on, and that. The economic problems of 2014 and 2015 really impressed upon him that eventually, at the end of the day, it's state and party power that really matters, and that if there's because there was a housing bubble, they pushed the money into the stock market popped or was threatened to pop, but and then they let it pop halfway, and then you had the currency reforms that made the problems with where the renminbi was going. Then you had the famous circuit breaker in early 2016 that became the circuit accelerator. And that, those were all real, genuine crises, and those were major learning moments. And the content of the 13th five-year plan, I think, changed fundamentally as a result of those experiences. And the chapter on supply-side reform was tucked in at the very end, in the front, really indicating the significant change. So it could be, yeah, Xi Jinping's always been a deep interventionist, you know, and we just didn't see it. Or I think there's actually been some significant learning. But of course, I do also think he's pragmatic. And so if he's got some space to make some changes that look like what we thought were third plenum reforms, we should not be absolutely surprised. So right now, pre-third plenum, the Chinese Development Research Center under the State Council and the World Bank wrote a report called China 2030. It was kind of a blueprint of the third plenum, right? They're now working on another report called New Drivers of Growth, which is more detailed and has some of the same things mentioned in it. Mm-hmm. So again, I think mixed picture, right? Let's remember both halves of the sentence.
Anyone else?
I tend to agree that, you know, one of the things that Xi Jinping encountered after the 12th Party Congress was the realization of how much, how kind of freewheeling not just the tech companies, but some of the insurance companies, et cetera, were, and that there was an effort to begin to try and rein them in. The problem is, I think when they started to rein them in, they realized that you have the problem of Guo and Gui, and the fact that even though he's mostly seems to be a lot of hot air, where was the big dump of data, of dirt that was supposed to occur at 19th Party Congress. The problem that I think partly they've encountered is they've gotten into the anti-corruption campaign is China is rapidly evolving into a plutocracy where power and wealth are linked by blood, marriage, and old school ties. And that when you start pulling back and you start trying to rein in the tycoons, you start to discover who is a stockholder, who's got an investment here, who are they related to, and you create a situation where trying to rein in, you know, trying to impose the state control, you begin to run the risk that there's an awful lot of dirty laundry that you don't want to expose. I mean, Bloomberg, New York Times have done this with Xi Jinping's family and with Wen Jiabao. There are other investigations going on that show this kind of overlapping of the business community and the state power. How do you deal with that? And in the context of how do you regulate the economy? How do you rein in the kind of what they call the crocodiles? All of that interferes with liberalization because, as Scott says, you've got two parts to that statement. In the latter statement, you know, there's the realization that, you know, maybe we don't want to go much further down the road of liberalization because what happens if the center of power shifts away from the party and the political apparatus? What happens when you get the Jack Ma's who, when you give them a hint, they don't take it? And what happens when you get the next generation where when you ask them out to tea, they're like, we're too busy. We got other things to do. So there is this macro problem of how do you maintain control? How do you maintain the dominance of the political side of things?
Yeah, I think just to add on, you know, since neither of you guys mentioned it, you know, if you have to wrap up the approach in a phrase, top level design. You know, and so, you know, that's the interesting sort of piece. And it's in the third plenum documents. There are, you know, references to it, and they've sort of stuck with that all along. And certainly that's how they manage the various crises that Scott alluded to. And I think that even within the context of the third plenum document, if you thought there was going to be a market-oriented fire sale of state assets, you know, that's just not Xi Jinping's approach to life. So. Let's see, up here in the front, in the gray jacket, blue tie.
Thank you. My name is Ding Ding from the IMF. I also had questions on China's economic long-run economic policies. For the past decades, economic policies in China have been driven by the annual growth target. In President Xi's speech, he did not mention any quantitative targets for the long run, not even mentioning the existing target of doubling the real GDP by 2020. Do you think that's a genuine signal that they're moving away from the focus on growth targets to the quality of growth and through, you know, state intervention or any other structural reforms? Thank you.
Sure. The short answer is yes. Not only was it not mentioned, they came out later and had a press conference and said, we didn't mention it on purpose. It's not in there. We're never going to mention it again. But I don't think that means that they don't care about the growth rate. They don't care, but what they don't care now about is a high growth rate, about fast growth. And in fact, they are very conscious of achieving certain growth targets. They're just lower. So we were told, you know, our sort of background idea is a growth rate of somewhere around 4.8% up until 2035, and then about 3.5% out to 2050. So they still have numbers in their mind. They're just a lot lower, and they're not worth publicizing in the same way that these higher numbers were. And they realize that setting those higher targets out there then generates a lot of behavior, which generates debt, and it's, you know, cheap sugar calorie coated type of growth, which they want to avoid. I think they'd like higher quality growth, indeed. They're just going to have to figure out how you're going to get that with the challenges of dealing with state-owned enterprises, a genuine debt problem, an aging population with demographics. And so, you know, I think most economists who look at the economy still think even the numbers I just mentioned are unrealistic, and that they will need to aim a little bit south of those, and then actually that would be relatively fine. And I'm less, just as an economic analyst, I'm less interested in the average rate of growth than I am in the volatility and what China's business cycles look like and how high they are or how low they go. And I think we've seen a little bit of improvement in the tops and bottoms of business cycles the last several years in the headline numbers, but we've seen big volatility in terms of price supply, in terms of the currency, in terms of commodity prices, in terms of housing. And so I think what they still need to figure out is not how to get that lower growth trajectory, but how to get the ups and the downs to be more balanced and to make it so they don't have these sudden shocks, which then require them to think about buying up shares on the stock market or driving trucks to banks.
Yeah, I think it's also just very important to take into account there's a lot of politics in this as well, you know. And if you're Xi Jinping, now that you have had a big win at the Party Congress, the only thing you're focused on now is 2021 has to be a good year, right? This is the message throughout the system. You know, actually, U.S. presidents used to understand this too. You know, if you're going to have some bad years, do it early in your term so that things are turning back by the time you're ready for re-election. And so I think they're sending a very clear signal about their willingness to tolerate lower growth. I think also we have to start appreciating more and more, unfortunately for all of us who have to read this stuff, the close connection between ideology and ideological phrasing and actual policy in a Xi Jinping universe. You know, the notion of the change in the primary contradiction, for example, it's not just a slogan. You know, it's very clearly a broad effort moving toward a more sort of balanced and, you know, giving people a happier life and so on. So this is here to stay. And then also, tactically, it's fairly brilliant. You know, you come up with a new 2035 midpoint target. You suggest, therefore, that everything's moving faster than we thought. You know, the guy from the Financial and Economic Leading Group, Yang Weimin, that Scott referred to, said this. You know, well, we're actually 15 years ahead. Aren't we doing a great job? And yet there are no specific targets that you're going to be judged by. It's pretty smart from a sort of straight politics point of view. Ma'am, yeah, just wait for the microphone, please.
Hi, Emily Weinstein, Georgetown University. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on U.S. credibility going forward in Sino-American cooperation, especially with regards to security and diplomacy.
So it depends what you mean by credibility. I would say that, for better or for worse, I think the escalating pressure that the United States has put on and the rhetoric, the unpredictable rhetoric vis-a-vis North Korea, for example, makes U.S. Threats to use military options more credible than they've been in a very long time. Now, I personally think that's a bad strategy. I don't think that threatening those, you know, Kim Jong-un acts the way he does not because he was uncertain about the balance of power on the peninsula. He understands maybe the United States' greater willingness to use it, but there's no situation under which he's going to give up nuclear weapons through negotiation. So the United States can fly self-bombers all they want. It's not going to happen. But on that side, I think the unpredictability of the president, some of the rhetoric of the president makes it seem, in some cases, more likely that the United States would resort to military options. Also, the dominance of, you know, retired military members, basically, in this administration, which is providing a certain viewpoint on how to best handle these issues. If you're talking about kind of a more liberal view of credibility, kind of like the United States willingness or ability to uphold commitments more broadly, whether they be, you know, economic commitments or commitments in international institutions. I think for a very long time, you know, the world has always known that democracies lead to these types of situations in which with a change of power you can have a change in policy. That's what makes it difficult for democracies to commit to things in the long term in many cases. Now, we've had a good run in which we have created, you know, there's this idea that a state creates a reputation. We think about the reputation of the United States. There's a reason we don't think about the reputation of the United States every 4 years. But I think the biggest issue when it comes to U.S.-China relations is the following. The United States says that, at least previously, now we're a little up in the air, but that we make decisions based on upholding certain principles and norms in the international system. But our behavior does not correspond with that. In a lot of cases, and this is somewhat controversial, but a lot of cases, defending our allies and upholding international principles are not the same thing, right? If we are about freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, we're about that whether China is harassing Vietnam or the Philippines. But if we only really respond when they're hurting our friends, then it's hard to do that. And in the end, the United States has to make the decision, are we maintaining the policy of we welcome the rise of China as long as they do it peacefully, which I think was the previous statement, but then that means that if China starts constructing international institutions to promote their power, that is a peaceful means of accumulating, exercising power. But we seem to be against that. So is it that, you know, if China becomes more powerful than the United States, that's unacceptable regardless of how they do it? And I think that's kind of an open-ended question that we were hoping, or I was hoping, that there'd be some strategic guidance from the top, because that guidance was missing the past 8 years. I don't think that guidance is coming anytime soon, so they're going to leave it up to kind of lower level military commanders, PACOM commander, you know, to do what they want to do. But I guess in the end, I'm not as worried that this kind of blip in U.S. credibility is going to last beyond these 4 years. Hopefully, I say only 4 years.
I think that's a great point. And then just to add to that, I think the notion that it's all about a counter narrative, right? If you're not producing a counter narrative in security, economic, diplomatic policy that highlights the warts in the other guy's narrative, then suddenly that narrative, you know, I mean, when Xi Jinping goes to Davos and, you know, comports himself as the defender of international, you know, trade and so on, it seems laughable. But again, when something gets repeated over and over again, it starts to sound sane if there's no, you know, functioning counter narrative. Let's come back to this side of the room. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Carrie Zhao from AEI, and I have a question on the topic that China's increasing projecting its power globally. So I'm just wondering, what do you think in the next 5 years, apart from the One Belt One Road, China's effort will be to increase its global influence? Thanks.
So I've done a lot of work on this particular issue, and it seems somewhat nuanced, but I think it's important to note first that China does not have, in my view, ambitions to be a global military power in the way that the United States has. A lot of China's push for the military to play a role outside of the region, I think, has stemmed from the fact that China has huge investments overseas, has now, they say, like 100 million citizens at any point in time overseas. And there's huge domestic support for the military to play a role in protecting those interests and protecting those individuals. So this is kind of anecdotal, but the box office hit of China this year, right, number one movie that sold more tickets in China's history, was a movie about a retired special forces operator who went to an unnamed African country to rescue Chinese citizens that were under siege there. But this type of narrative is very popular domestically. So I think this has pushed China outward. Also, there's the benefit of looking like you're a responsible international player, right? For better or for worse, the United States has been encouraging this, right? China should take on more of the burden whether it's peacekeeping operations, in which they're now they're the largest contributors in the P5, to the anti-piracy operations. So where is this going? One of the things I would say as a China specialist, there's always certain areas in which we say, this will never happen, okay? And I remember when it used to be like, you know, China loans international institutions. They'll never be a part of international institutions. And then it was, you know, then they don't really need or want an aircraft carrier. They're never going to get an aircraft carrier. Now the narrative is about overseas bases. China's against alliances. It's against overseas bases. They will never do this. But you never know with China. And Djibouti now being technically an overseas access point, the Chinese I talk to tell me that they are absolutely going to build more overseas bases. But, and this is new, because last year I asked and they were like, you Americans are obsessed with this. You know, we're a different type of great power. Why do you keep asking me this question? But now it's like, we're absolutely going to build them, but our basing structure is going to be fundamentally different from that of the United States, in that we're not going to pre-position kind of offensive systems or individuals. They're going to be mainly logistical or access points. So maybe some people who don't look at this kind of want to call BS on that, but I don't know. I kind of believe that type of rationale, or at least I believe that they believe it. It doesn't mean it won't change in the future.
Great. Well, with that, we're at time. So I would ask the audience to please help me in thanking the participants today.